Thank you for coming. It's a great sunny day to be talking about this very important subject. The Fullerton Unitarian Universalist Congregation is sponsoring this speaking engagement with Dr. Woodrow Clark II. The theme is environmental and economic sustainability. Unitarian Universalists reflect upon and abide by seven principles, including the inherent dignity and equality of all people, promoting justice and compassion, acceptance of a wide spectrum of thought and cultures, the search for truth and wisdom, the use of the democratic process, and to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature. Living in harmony with the rhythms of nature underscores the theme of this presentation on sustainability. Dr. Clark was a co-recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007 for his work on the UN Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change. You may consider environmental and economic sustainability and a sequel to An Inconvenient Truth. Dr. Clark is a longtime advocate for the environment and renewable energy. He is an internationally recognized author, lecturer, advisor, specializing in sustainable communities. He founded Clark Strategic Partners in 2004, which is an environmental and renewable energy consulting firm. And he used his political and economic expertise to do so. He has been serving public and private clients worldwide, whom he helps with primarily sustainable development projects. Dr. Clark has been an advisor to the governor of California, and he'll tell you which governor in a moment, a university professor, a Fulbright fellow, and a manager at Lawrence Livermore Lab. His latest book, published last year, is titled Sustainable Communities Toward Energy Independence and Carbon Neutral Communities. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Woodrow Clark.
Thank you, Dale. We're going to have some slides that I put together for today. They're going to be available online through the website for the church. I also want to point out that, as Dale said, this is my latest book, Sustainable Communities, but actually I have another book that just came out like 3 or 4 weeks ago called Sustainable Communities Design Handbook, and that's this one. And what we will do, I don't have copies of these books with me, so what I'm going, other than this, what I'm going to do, or we'll work out some arrangement to, if people want to get them, they're from Amazon.com. By the way, I make like pennies to a book. That's no big deal. But if you're here and you want to get a book and have it signed, I'll be able to do that. We'll figure out some way to do it, so we'll make that work. Okay? There's no discount for the book or anything like that, and I apologize. But, although, we had a very interesting conversation, which, can I mention about this? Okay. I gave a sermon this morning, and in that context, I mentioned something which I'll talk about in some detail in this talk. But one of them was the possibility of, like, putting solar panels over the parking structure here, which keeps your cars cooler when you go out and also generates energy, right? So we were discussing this, and the church may, in fact, kind of worked on that, and maybe even come in partnership with the temple next door. And one of the things I know is some of the companies actually provide discounts, purchase discounts to organizations like a church, like an office building, or even residential apartments or condos for everybody. If it's, basically not everyone's buying the system, but they're actually contributing or being a part of that, so they get a discount on a mass purchase agreement of some sort. So that might be something worth following through. Anyway, what I'm going to do, though, is talk a little more in detail about what it means to essentially be, as I said, a sequel to An Inconvenient Truth. Now, I want to point out, as I said earlier today in the sermon, that Al Gore himself actually had a sequel to his book and his film called Our Choice, A Plan to Solve the Climate Crisis. This just came out 4 or 5 months ago. I have a signed copy of myself from him because I went to his talk, and it was unusual with him. He's got 800 or 900 people in the audience. It was a mass riot scene because he was signing the books afterwards. But He actually did do a sequel to An Inconvenient Truth. Now, before that happened, I had this idea after seeing the film that there really needed to be a sequel, because that film, that documentary, if you will, that story that he was telling, was fantastic. It did a great job of making the public and politicians and others aware of the problem. We can have a discussion today about some of that, and we will be time at the end of this for a Q&A process where we can get into some dialogue. That's great. I know, terrific from my point of view. But the fact of the matter was, The Inconvenient Truth, if you've seen it, had only one thing in it that talked about how to solve the problem. And it wasn't him saying it. It was just one little line, tagline. It said something like, change your light bulbs. Do you want me to repeat that? That's not enough, Al. That's a start. And what I'm going to talk about today is with the things that all of us in this room can do as a start, and then what we can do in addition to that to actually start reversing the impact of climate change and global warming and environmental problems. And I say that because if we don't, then this young man back here, I'm Woody, what's your name?
Dylan.
Dylan? We're giving Dylan a world that's horrible. And all of us sitting in this audience have to own up to it and take responsibility. Because he's going to need it. He's going to need our help. And that's the reason I'm here today, and that's why I want to talk about, and that's why I'm hoping many of you, if you don't or hadn't thought about it, keep in touch with me. I hope I can help or provide you with some resources. This is not about selling books, don't get me wrong. It has nothing to do with it. It's just that it's important that we all take action, and we do it, because we owe it to our future generation, our children and our grandchildren. So with that, let me just do a couple of introductory things. A couple of you may notice that this guy, Clark, has an awful lot of degrees. Like, what does MA cubed mean? It means I have too many master's degrees, literally three of them. Okay? And the reason for that was, well, it's a long story, but let's put it in summary, that and my PhD all equal a degree in sustainable development. But back 20, 25, even 30 years ago when I started all this stuff, that wasn't even a subject. Wasn't anything in anybody's mind. I was talking over lunchtime with a colleague here who was saying he does websites and has done that here for the church. Well, we were discussing the fact that wasn't even a field 10 years ago. So what we're seeing today is a new field. So my master's degrees and PhD are in all different areas. That's in fact, some of those areas are political science, economics, anthropology, linguistics. Now, does that add up to what you would define as sustainable development? Yes. You're probably thinking, what is this guy, crazy? No, it does add up to that because, in fact, this latest book I just mentioned that came out a couple of weeks ago does that. It talks about the need for having policy, economics, accounting, law, engineering, design. All those things are needed for our communities to become sustainable. They are integrated disciplines, and they must be. Just to have an architect or designer, let alone an engineer or a physicist, design this building or your home is not enough. We've got to get these other kinds of disciplines involved. And that's why we're seeing more of that happen on college campuses today. We're seeing more and more of these integrated systems and programs. And I'm now doing a lot of teaching on college campuses in this area and setting up advanced degree programs just for that purpose. So, for example, the University of California, Berkeley, just announced a master program in sustainable development, funded by the MacArthur Association. There's more and more of that that's coming. I hope more and more of it comes. When I first started teaching in this area, well over 10 years ago, it wasn't. I won't mention the name of the university, but it's located in Malibu. That wasn't a joke. Pepperdine. I was teaching in their MBA program, and one of the things I was trying to do is teach sustainability in terms of business development. And they didn't like it. So I taught for 1 year, then they didn't renew it or whatever. 2 or 3 years later, they thought this was a great idea, and they started their own program. Now, I think, imitation is the greatest form of flattery. But the fact of the matter is we have to have more of this. We have to have more of it at all levels and at all institutions, and we're seeing a lot more of it. So what I'm going to talk about today is some of those, if you will, more details. The other thing I wanted to mention is that this book here, it looks like a ship, doesn't it? if you looked at it real closely, it looked like a Nordic ship. If you look really closely, you'll notice it's from Denmark. That's because this is a book called Qualitative Economics. You can't read it, but it's the subtitle of it is Toward the Science of Economics. Let me repeat that. Toward a Science of Economics. If you didn't get it the first time, we'll get into this in some detail. Science, ready everyone, is not, economics is not a science. Not a joke, I'm not kidding. But the fact of the matter is, we have a lot of people out there who talk about using statistics and various kinds of numbers to justify their actions or non-actions, and those numbers are questionable. And so when I talk about being a qualitative economist, I'm talking about someone who wants to define and know the meanings of numbers. I won't get into all the details I mentioned earlier in my sermon this morning, but it in part came because I was in state government, under Governor Davis, by the way, and we were looking at numbers that we were getting from companies like Enron, and they were questionable. When you get a number, 1 plus 1 equals 7, it's validated by an accounting firm like Anderson. I mean, like, wait a minute. Fast forward, those people are all in jail, and okay. Now, the fact I'm trying to make and the point I'm trying to make is this: we have got to constantly question the numbers that people throw at us, either for or against or whatever. We've got to constantly do that. That's what science is all about. So that's my field, qualitative economics. I think you'll probably hear more about it, at least I hope you do, because it's relatively new. And my colleague in writing that book is actually a Danish professor, and he and I did this book together a couple years ago. In fact, we did it. It came out in 2008. The book had been done really like a year and a half, 2 years before. And in that book, we predicted what happened later in 2008. Anybody know what happened in the fall? This book came out in June. Anyone know what happened in the fall of 2008? You got it. The nosedive. We predicted it in the book because of the issue of numbers. And it didn't make sense. And what I'm getting at is that's the kind of thing in getting us out of our current economic downfall. What we have to look at, what we have to be very mindful of. And so that's going to be a major theme in what I'm going to talk about this afternoon. Okay, so let's go to the next slide, Dale. And, okay, climate change, global warming, however you want to call it, okay, it is worldwide. We're talking about something when it happens in another part of the world has an impact on us here in California. What we do in California has impacts in other parts of the world as well, including other parts of the United States, even other states like Nevada and Arizona, etc. Now, the reason I show this is because there are some people who think the world is flat. And what I'm trying to... That was a joke. No, I got that one. Okay. I mentioned that in the sermon, Mr. Friedman. The fact of the matter is... Did everyone get that? Do I need to say more about that one? All right. The fact of the matter is that what happens in China, you know, here, does have an impact on our water and our atmosphere here in California, and of course what happens in California does impact the rest of the United States. So what we are seeing, in other words, is something that we cannot ignore or say, oh, that's their problem. Oh, we'll do something locally, but we won't be mindful of what we have to do also either regionally or internationally or even nationally or for the state. We've got to really be active in all these areas. It starts locally, but very much is international and regional. Next slide. So some of the impacts of this, in terms of the science of climate change, what we're seeing is warming trends in areas of much more tornadoes and hurricanes, ice melts. I spend sometimes hours just showing slides of this. So there was an area in Antarctica, the size of the state of Rhode Island, that broke off and started to melt. That's huge. And that impacts the oceans throughout the world. What we're also seeing is a warming in Greenland. My colleagues, where I used to teach in Denmark, and I still have very close relations with the Danish and professors and academics as others, but Denmark is actually not so much in control, but oversees Greenland. And so the Danes have been very concerned about what happens in Greenland because of the warming of the whole region. So we're seeing this continually go, even I think it was last year, the North Pole did not freeze over. So there's a consistent pattern here of things that are going on that are not made from nature. They have to do with each of us in this room. We are here in part to take responsibility for it and then to do something. The facts are they're getting worse and worse. Next slide. So, how do we begin to look at the problems and see, you know, what's going to happen with it? Well, I like this slide. I'll go on this slide real quick. Because, remember I said my book in 2008 came out. And then the following year, 2009, after the economic collapse globally, The Economist, does everyone know The Economist, have heard about it? I love to read The Economist. It's kind of like when I turn on Fox News for 10 seconds. It gets my blood boiling, you know? Maybe you don't know. But for me, anyways, it gets my mind really kind of moving ahead or whatever. Well, when you look at The Economist, you'll find it very much into sort of what many of us refer to as neoclassical economics. It goes way back to Adam Smith. It goes back to The Invisible Hand. It goes back to government is bad. The only thing that's good is the market, the market, the market. Well, guess what? The Economist, this is their cover, has a Bible, and I thought this was very appropriate for this group, melting, called Modern Economic Theory. And in that issue, they basically validated what my book a year before that had talked about, that economics is not a science. If it was, their second point is they would have known there would be a global economic collapse, which, you know, a year, almost a year later, people were very cognizant of. Now, what do we do about it? What happens to it? Why is that important for climate change? Because many of the people who are pushing back on the issue of what to do about climate change are saying, A, we can't afford it, meaning it would cost money somewhere, where's it going to come from? And B, where's the economics from it? Is everybody sitting down? Because I'm going to show you. It's there. It's in concrete, and people have seen this and validated it over and over again. By the way, that's the definition of science. Have a hypothesis. Check it out. Validate it. Check it. Recheck it. Recheck it. So that's a little bit what you're going to see next, Dale. So let's talk about what sustainable communities are. This is just one of many illustrations. I just used this one because I thought it's kind of integrate some of the basics, which has to do with all these infrastructures. Is my pointer getting that far? Yeah. All these infrastructures are having to do with water, having to do with transportation, having to do with how we use waste or what we do with our waste. All of these are a part of what makes this community sustainable. And it's not just one. I do run across and talk to people often who say, well, if we just change the flow of this river, or if we just have a high-speed rail system from Northern California through Southern California, have it stop somewhere near the border, whatever, that will solve all of our problems. No, it's got to be that plus other things. Again, I was talking to a couple of people over lunchtime, and I mentioned the fact, some of you may know, the 405 freeway, you've seen it on TV. They're tearing it up. The idea is to put two more lanes, HOV lanes, on the 405 freeway. Does that mean that driving north and south on the 405 is going to be any better? No! You all know that in this community. You've seen what happens when you put one lane and two lanes. You get six or seven lanes or eight lanes on each side of the freeway with carpool lanes. It doesn't mean that. What they should have done, and what really upset me, and I made a very big stink about it, was they should put light rail above that system going north and south, getting people out of their cars. Getting people in a way of moving around in which they can really be environmentally sound and do something to alleviate our dependency in this country as a whole on oil and gas and fossil fuels. So we've got to see these systems integrated, and that's really, really critical. The other thing I see a lot of is people saying, oh, just put solar panels here and we'll be fine. Well, it's more than just solar panels. It has to do with your water. It has to do with your waste. It has to do with your gardens. It has to do with your food supply. It has to do with a whole bunch of other things. What you do with your bottles and cans and things when you're through using them. So it's got to be more than just one thing. They've got to be seen as integrated systems. Dale? So this gets to what I and others are now referring to. By the way, this is my next book coming out. It'll be out in early next year. I'm getting tired of writing so much. But anyway, this is called The Third Industrial Revolution. It's a major paradigm change. It was first identified, frankly, and put in writing by a very good friend of mine, Jeremy Rifkin. He's an environmental economist. And it came out in a book he did that was published in 2004, I think it was 2004 or 2006, called The European Dream. And with Jeremy, and I've been working with him for well over a dozen years or more, What he was basically saying are these things I've just listed here, although I put it more than what he has, because what it was basically renewable energy, integrated systems that we were talking about, smart grids, but I also added a couple of other things too, including education and curriculum. Because it's one thing for me or he or other people to talk about it, but it's much more beyond that. And what Jeremy does in his book is says that the third industrial revolution started in Europe. This is where he and I differ a little. Because I know for a fact that this third industrial revolution, away from fossil fuels, which is the second industrial revolution, has also been very significant in Japan and South Korea. Are you ready for this now? And guess who's involved with the third industrial revolution today? Not America. Who said it? China. The Chinese have leapfrogged into that revolution. Now, Woody, how do you know that? Well, for one thing, I've done a lot of work in China over the last 20, 25 years. I think there's even someone here today. Where is he? Your wife was just in China. Yeah, and we were talking over lunch about how amazing their essentially infrastructure and systems are. Because what the Chinese have done is said, and I'll tell you, here's how I know it for a fact. I did a project that ended about a year and a half ago for the Asian Development Bank. What it was is to look at Inner Mongolia, which is a region just north of Beijing. It's the second largest coal-producing region in China. And what the Chinese wanted to do and understand, and the Asian Development Bank, is how did Western energy infrastructure systems develop with their negative environmental impact? Then how could we in Inner Mongolia, this is almost verbatim repeating what the assignment was, how can we leapfrog the mistakes of the West? Not get in line, not copy what they did in Germany or what they're doing in the United States, no. Leapfrog. And that's what they're doing. Now, what does that mean for us sitting here in California, let alone in America? It means, as a colleague of mine says, we had better wake up. Because it's important to work with the Chinese, it's important to know these kinds of challenges, but they've also done something and learned, essentially, from our collective mistakes. And what we have to do is begin to say, okay, what can we do? So this third industrial revolution has already started in Europe and in parts of Asia, like I said, Japan and South Korea, and now you're seeing parts that are going on in China, which I'll give you some examples of in a minute. But the fact of the matter is, it's going on, and we in America have got to get on board. And let me give you one very concrete example. Anybody follow American politics knows, last Friday, that's less than 48 hours ago, the U.S. Congress and Senate did not, repeat not, pass an energy plan for this country. When you want to talk about stupidity, collective stupidity, that's it. What do they have in China? They have what they call five-year plans. I can't get my other thing, sorry about that. Five-year plans. Those five-year plans, they're now in their 13th, specifically say what we're going to do as a country, and we're going to put money behind it, and we're going to implement these things. And what the Chinese have done is said exactly what I was just talking about. Sustainable communities, as part of their plan, they're putting trillions of dollars, U.S. dollar equivalents, into this. And we in our country can't even have a plan. Now, I stand before you, and I'm very happy to discuss this with you. It has got nothing to do with the Chinese being a former communist country. It has nothing to do with being socialist. I teach MBA classes all over the United States and other parts of the world. I teach entrepreneurship specifically. And guess what? Do you know what I teach? That businesses need business plans. Does everybody hear what I'm saying? In other words, everybody needs a plan. You as parents, you as children, you as teachers, you as business owners, you need a plan. Without it, what are you going to do? That's called chaos. Maybe you enjoy that. Go on the beach and have a good time in your life. You'll be polluted if you don't watch out. But the fact that I'm trying to say is that that's what the Chinese have done. That's what we should be doing. And for those of you who want a label for it, call it social capitalism. Not socialistic. not capitalism, social capitalism, where you're really concerned about an issue like the climate and you have a plan and you put money behind it. Because there's nothing wrong with that. And that's what I was trying to get at before about when we talked about where is the economics, where is it all going? Well, unless we do something about that in America, we are really in trouble. If we don't do anything about it in California, we are really in trouble. I brought some of these issues up this morning in the sermon, and I can get into some details this afternoon if you like. But the fact I'm trying to get across to everybody is we need to start planning. And for the United States not to have an energy plan is really incredibly dumb. Well, let me go back. Remember the book I said that came out last year, this one? On sustainable communities. First sentence in the conclusion. What happened? So they saw my book. They seen the light. Is that what it is? Well, that's great. I hope they get this one down. All right. That never happened to me before, Dale. The point is, in the book, the last chapter, conclusion, the first sentence says, the United States needs an energy plan. And I can't emphasize that enough, but it needs plans related to other things as well. And so my point to everybody is, this is something that we have to really be mindful of and be very on top of and be aware of. I can put it in another way. The second industrial revolution, which I'll give you some more details in a minute, there actually was an energy plan. Everybody know what it was? Drill for oil, drill for gas, build combustion engines. Guess who those companies are? Exxon, you can keep going, Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, etc. Combustion engines, Chevy, Ford, Chrysler, ba-bum, ba-bum. Right? Are you all with me? Listen, ladies and gentlemen, that's ended. It's already ended in Europe and in parts of Asia. Why would we be stupid enough to keep doing it here in the United States and here in California? Thank God we've got some of the people up in Northern California, Tesla Motors, who have taken over the former GM Toyota plant, and they're making all electric cars now. So at least they're getting some progress in this, but we've got to do more. You even see Detroit changing some of it. But the fact is, if we don't get ahead of this curve, then Dylan in the back is going to be given a world and a car to drive that's really horrible for him. And who's responsible? Dylan, right now, if you listen to this, everybody in this room, because we didn't help you. So, next slide. Second Industrial Revolution. Here's some slides of what it looks like. Anybody recognize some of these slices? Mm-hmm. Oh, it gets better, folks. Next slide. Anybody recognize some of these places? Let's see now. That's called drilling for oil in the water, offshore. Second Industrial Revolution is go get it wherever you find it. Now, what I didn't show here was some pictures. Oh, by the way, just so you know, this is what this supposedly looks like. This is also where they're getting coal. This is all the transmission, taking it from these coal plants or the oil plants and then shipping it or sending it by transmission lines from point A to point B. I'll get back to that. This is part of liquefied natural gas, a whole other problem. Okay, but let's just deal with the issue now of fossil fuels. Where do you get oil? You can get it under the water. You can also find it in places like in the Middle East, which means, we in America are sending money to the Middle East, and there's some people in the Middle East who don't like us. Now, where are they getting their money to attack us? Dylan, you hear this one too? From all of us. Because we're buying that oil and gas continually. So then let's ask where else we can get the oil. You can also get it from shale. In other words, from actual ground and actually getting the oil from the ground. This is really particularly up in Alberta, Canada. I didn't show pictures of this, but I've got a very good friend of mine who teaches up at UC Berkeley. And he has these incredible pictures of thousands of miles of land destroyed because they're taking shale oil. The reason they're doing it is because now the price per gallon of oil is so nice that they figure, what the heck, we're just tear up the environment. You want to say that out loud?
$78 a barrel.
Okay, so, oh my goodness, we can make some money then, right? Okay, then we have coal. Anyone see any pictures of what happens in the Appalachian Mountains in America, other parts of the world, when they mine for coal, and what it does to the environment around it, to the waterways? We've got to recognize we are destroying our world, and we're responsible. Next slide. This is the Gulf. Now, I'm showing this to you because I know all of you here every night, Anderson Cooper, I don't know if he ever changes his shirt, but anyway, every night he's out there talking to someone else or someone who about it. I only show it to you because this is probably one of the worst environmental problems that's ever happened, certainly in the United States. But I'm showing it to you for another reason, because I can show you pictures of the Middle East, of the northern area of South America and near Venezuela. I can show you pictures of the North Sea between England and Norway. There have been oil spills in other parts of the world. This is not new news. The new news about it is we have a CNN headquartered right here in Atlanta. Georgia, Glen, Georgia. So they're right next door to this. And so it's kind of like it hits home for CNN, hence Anderson Cooper's down there all the time. The fact is, we don't get enough news and information about where it's also happened in other parts of the world. This has been going on for a long time. When I was working at Lawrence Livermore National Lab in the mid-1990s, I was part of a group looking at energy, and one of the things we did is look at it in terms of the Scandinavian countries. And Norway has actually got one of the biggest oil-producing, gas-producing regions in the world. A lot of us don't know. We always think, oh, it's got to be Saudi Arabia or, you know, Iraq or something. Well, Norwegians, kind of like people in Alaska, pay no taxes because they make so much money from the oil and gas that they're drilling, they get paid by the government, same as goes on in Alaska. So what's happened is they became very dependent on oil and gas, and then in the mid-1990s found because of oil spills and other problems, they needed to cut it off. So they've moved very, very quickly into this third industrial revolution, and if you go and visit them today, you'll see some of the things that they're doing. The second part of this is that this picture, while it shows the Gulf of Mexico, take that same picture and superimpose it on Alaska, superimpose it on other offshore areas of the United States, and what you will see is the same kind of possibility and problem. Mr. Obama, who I have a great deal of respect for, supported offshore drilling until this thing happened. And now he's put a stop to it. I hope it's a permanent stop. And everyone in this audience needs to let their legislators and others know it needs to be permanent. There's no reason we could allow this to happen or continue. And again, Dylan is the one who's going to inherit it. All of us may be gone by then. Okay? Next slide. This is the reason in pure economics as to why we have to stop. Ladies and gentlemen, this chart from the U.S. Department of Energy is almost 10 years old, I might add, by the way, so it's gotten worse. Shows how much oil, how much natural gas, how much coal. And the thing that shocked some of my national laboratory colleagues is uranium that's left in the world. So for people like Mr. Thomas Friedman, who loves your nuclear power, a few others, unfortunately, at the U.S. Department of Energy in Washington, we don't have a lot of it left. Dylan will still be alive, well, and in his being a grandfather age, when we run out of uranium. But meanwhile, there are people in this room who are going to see the end of oil, clearly the end of natural gas. Coal goes on forever, but frankly, folks, we need to stop using it. So what we have in terms of economics is a very short supply, yet high cost, for really something that is actually part, as I said before, the second industrial revolution. And frankly, we need to move on sooner than later. Next slide, yeah. I want you to look at this and read it carefully. It's a picture of a hybrid car. 1903 comes from Germany. Does anyone want me to repeat? It's a picture of a hybrid car that was not invented by Toyota 5 years ago. They have been around for a long time. If you see a documentary film called Fuel, or another one called Who Killed the Electric Car, I can go on, they actually document this, that these vehicles were in existence well over 100 years ago. What happened? Second Industrial Revolution, fossil fuel, combustion engine, boom. Goodbye, electric vehicle or hybrids. So Fuel had something very interesting in it, which I didn't know until I saw it. Henry Ford, man who founded Ford Motor Company, he actually was the first person using biofuels for cars. And he did it through the 1920s, partly because he owned large acreages of farmland. But he changed over to fossil fuels because of the pressure from Standard Oil and others. So what you have, in other words, is these vehicles go back well over 100 years, have been in existence, and we put them on the shelf, or as in the film, Who Killed the Electric Car, some of the car companies, from political pressure and other things, pulled them out, destroyed them, and that was the end of electric vehicles in the mid-19, late 1990s. Next slide, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, I thought there was another. Do you know how to go back on this? Now, this gets to something I want to really make very clear. First of all, how many people in this room own a hybrid car, a Prius or whatever? How many people have? Great. You'll be shocked at what I'm going to tell you next. All right. How many have all electric cars? Anybody? There we go. We're going to interview this gentleman afterwards. All right. Anybody have a hydrogen fuel cell car? No? Anyone know what they are yet? Hydrogen fuel cell car. I'll explain a little bit later. But let's go back to the hybrid. Anyone know where Toyota got the technology for that car? Anybody? It's called regenerative braking. I want you people who own a Prius to put it on, I have a Prius too, put it on your screen where it has information about the car and you'll see it working. That technology came from all of you. You, the American taxpayers, paid for that technology that was developed when I was at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and other national labs in the United States in the early, mid-1990s. And you know what happened? Because of technology transfer and trying to get the technologies into the market, American companies had the first right of refusal. And not necessarily in this order, but GM, Ford, and Chrysler turned it down. The Japanese said, this is a good idea. Environmental, it's important, less fossil fuels. They licensed it. 2 years ago, Ford licensed it back from them, the first round of it. Meanwhile, Toyota's come with three new generations of regenerative braking. So, outside of the zones, thank you. Because now Toyota's the number one car maker in the world. And what happened to Detroit? A couple of bankruptcies, a couple of, whatever. A whole bunch of things. My point, ladies and gentlemen, is this. We are an innovative, creative nation, and we've got to get our act together. If I was at a bar sometime late at night talking to all of you about this, I would say we've got to get our shit together. Because we've got to do something. It's ridiculous. We're actually inventing these things, and then we're not doing anything with them. Because what we've been doing is still acting in the second industrial revolution, and we've got to get out of it. We've got to move ahead. And we can do it in the leapfrog concept as well. So let me go into some of that for a minute. Next. This slide shows actually a major part of a book that I did called, it was after the recall of Governor Davis. By the way, I never say that I was fired. I was part of his administration, so I was recalled. I think it's a better way of looking at it, Anyway, what we worked on, though, in Governor Davis' administration, obviously, was the California energy crisis. And what after the crisis, a colleague and I wrote a book called Agile Energy Systems. And this chart, actually from The Economist, by the way, does illustrate what that means. And what it means is this, that instead of having, my pointer died, okay, instead of having here in the upper left-hand corner, which is kind of a light blue color, this is called the central plant, where you generate power from coal, even in concentrated solar or wind farms or whatever, but from whatever the source is, and then you transmit it over long series of transmission poles or lines or pipes or whatever to another location for use in your home, your factory, or your office building. What happened during the energy crisis in California is what we learned was that these systems, while okay to some extent, were really a lot dependent on fossil fuels. And what we had to do is instead create systems that could be with solar or wind or other combinations that could go on buildings or on your homes or in some complexes here at the church or whatever that would allow you to, in other words, generate your own power. Now, this is in 2003. At that period of time, there was not really much in the state government or at the national level in the United States that supported that idea because the utilities here in Edison territory, for example, were very much against it. It meant competition from their point of view. If you're generating power here at the church, well, maybe you're not buying it at the same rate you would be from Edison every day. Now, since that time, some things have changed, and I'll get into some of those details. But the fact of the matter is that there's nothing wrong with generating power here at the church, selling it to Edison. When you don't have power at night because there's no sun or no wind or whatever, you buy it back from them. Then at the end of the time, you figure out what those costs are and who's going to owe who what. And it will be a very small amount, frankly, from the church's point of view. But that's something new that started at the turn of this last century and actually was inspired because of some work I had done in Europe and my colleague who co-wrote the book with me. Because the fact is we have to get away from these central plants and see our own homes and our communities and our buildings capable of generating power in order for us to be energy independent. If not, then we're going to have to use these central plants, get the coal from someplace, get the gas or the oil, bring that in, generate the power, and then transmit it, losing upwards of 30 to 40% efficiency in the transmission process. So that's a major argument about what we have to do in the third industrial revolution. Slightly different than what they're doing in Europe and in Asia, but it does give us a very strong, if you will, competitive advantage when we look at things pretty much in that way. So next slide. So, if we take this to the most logical conclusion, one of the things we do is say, I have a slide, for example, that shows the United States. It's from the National Renewable Energy Lab in Colorado and shows various kinds of renewable sources throughout the United States. I'm not showing that because there's too many slides and I don't really have time, but you can imagine, in other words, in this region, California and the Southwest, you have a lot of sunshine, same in the southern part of the United States. So frankly, you have a lot of solar possibilities. This chart shows primarily wind. The reason I wanted to show you this is because it not only shows wind, one of the slides I used from the National Renewable Energy Lab until recently was showing the wind areas only. And we have a few places here in California, but also in the upper and lower Midwest. And now there are a lot of wind farms now in Iowa and Minnesota and the Dakotas. But what this shows is the potential for wind offshore. In other words, wind generating power rather than oil derricks drilling for oil. Now, I know that some of you may say, my view from my home in Malibu will be destroyed by that wind turbine, I'm sure. Well, I think we've got to start looking at what we can do. We don't necessarily have to have them all offshore. If you go to other parts of the world, you travel to Copenhagen or to Hamburg or other parts of Asia or other parts of Europe as well, you'll see wind turbines generating power near airports. That's one of their things. They have power, and they kept away from the actual air landing patterns. And also in other parts of the world, you don't have either wind farms, but you also have individual wind turbines in communities on farmland or in villages. And I'll get into some of that in a minute. But the fact of the matter is, we in the United States have all these things about, well, what's it going to do for the scenery? Well, frankly, I just drove down Route 1 through Santa Barbara 2 weeks ago, and I have to tell you, I'm not thrilled with those oil derricks offshore. And in other words, we have options, and we need to use those options. That's what this shows. The only wind turbine in an urban part of North America today is one that's in Toronto, in Lake Ontario. And guess what? It isn't an American, it's a Canadian operation. So what we've got to do is start rethinking about how we're going to deal with our issues of climate change and energy generation and other things in a very much different way. Next slide. So, for example, these are some things about wind and tidal. In other words, the sea flowing. You can also harness that for power as well. And this just shows some of the areas that are now being considered on the east coast of the United States. I think we have a lot of water here in California, last I checked, right? We can do the same thing here. And what we've got to do is figure out where those resources are, how to capture them, and then how to utilize them. The reason I show this is, in fact, if you go back and imagine the picture I showed before about the oil spill in the Gulf, is one of the things that people are concerned about with that spill, and still concerned, as they should be, is it in fact could come up the east coast, around Florida, and into the Carolinas, and maybe as high up as in New York City or New Jersey. So what we have, in other words, is a problem that we have options as to how to solve that problem, rather than going by way of the oil drills and oil spill possibilities. Next slide. This shows a picture of what can happen. You can put these solar panels, for example, on buildings like this, generating power. And when, as I said before, the sun's not shining at night, then you have to take a look at this power and say, well, we'll sell it to Edison or the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and we'll buy it back and get the resources when we need to have the energy at nighttime for our computers or our television or whatever. Now, I mention this, though, and show this picture in particular because the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power does not get it yet. And there's a big struggle going on now in L.A. regarding that. Edison's been a little more progressive in that regard. Not totally, but somewhat. But these are some of the issues that all of you need to be thinking about in your daily lives. Next slide, Dale. And that gets me to start talking about some of the solutions. Some of the solutions have to, again, do with finance. So this is a program that was started in Germany almost two decades ago, early 1990s. It's called the feed-in tariff. There are various kinds of ways of looking at this concept, but basically what it says is let's have money that's paid for by the ratepayer, and then we put that money back into letting the ratepayer, business or an individual, use that money to buy renewable power. So that feed-in tariff will actually charge you a larger amount of money per month for your energy. But what you're able to do is somewhat kind of looking at it like borrowing that money to put in solar panels on your roof or in your building or whatever. Now, this shows you the impact of that over a 20-year period. And you'll notice here that in 2000, it just went crazy. It went off the roof. No pun intended, by the way. But the point is, and the reason for that, is that the Germans learned that when you have a feed-in tariff that provides very little money for installing solar panels, then you're not going to have very much activity. It's when it provides more money, a higher percent, that's when the numbers really increase. And I mention this and make it very clear because the next slide even documents it further. Next slide. This shows what the German feed-in tariff did for the economy in Germany. Germany is the number one, I think actually not to be replaced by Italy, to tell you the truth, but it's been the number one solar manufacturing and installation country in the world. If you haven't heard lately, I'll tell you now, they have a lot of snow, cloudy days, and rain in Germany. That is not a joke, okay? So how do they do that? It's because what they've done is had very active, progressive policies in their government that said, look, we're going to be able to, if we do this, we'll create more solar and wind, biomass, and hydropower in Germany, and the solar areas where they really accelerated, and we're also going to be creating more jobs. And they've documented it. Over about a 5 or 6 year period here in this slide, they created well over 250,000 jobs in Germany. And as I said, Germany is number one in this, and now challenged, frankly, by Italy, which has now become very close to the number one, if not number one. Next slide. Then this comes to some of the issues that I wanted to get into as part of one of the books. And I'll go through this fairly quickly, not that you need to memorize all of this. But when we're doing the financials on this information, you'll find that the cost-benefit analysis that most economics and accounting people use doesn't work. What we're really looking at are what are called externalities in economics. And that's what this is beginning to do as a part of one of the chapters in the book. In other words, the numbers have got to be looked at, but over a longer period of time. So, if you're getting a solar panel or a wind turbine or something like that, it's going to take you a little bit longer to pay that back than a 2 or 3 year cost-benefit analysis. That's okay, because normally if your own home or if you have the office building that you own or something, you're going to have it for a period of time. Now, since this chapter came out, there have been some interesting analyses of this that have gone even further. One of them, I think it's in the next slide, actually. No, okay, I think I'll pick it up later. But these are ways in which you can finance for a longer period of time and pay back and also make a nice profit on it in terms of your own home or your office building. But this just shows a configuration of how these systems could work. Remember what I said before about agile energy systems? So here's your home. And I have to show you. This is generating power in part from the solar. But you also have here an electric charger for your car. You can see the line to your electric car. These homes and these other buildings are really what are called smart green communities. And they exist. Not a lot, but there are more and more that are coming. I was just at a conference giving a talk on this at Stanford University about a month and a half ago. And this has become a very, very important model. You see it happening in other parts of the world, and we're beginning to see it more and more here in the United States. Next slide. This just shows where we have to start. Just remember what I said about the Third Industrial Revolution? One of the key factors was efficiency and conservation. This has to do with cutting down the amount of power that we're using for our homes and for our offices and other things. And that really means just being mindful, not just turning off the switches, but being sure we have the screen savers and light bulbs and things that don't use as much power. There's a program in California called Flex Your Power. If you haven't seen it or heard of it, you might want to look it up on a website. It gets all kinds of suggestions and ideas on how to control your power use in your own home. Or you can get Energy Star, which is a national program from Washington, labels that are on your appliances. Look for those things. They're very important. Very, very, very important. Next slide. This shows, in again, another chapter in the book on Santa Monica. Santa Monica does a report card on itself. And you think Santa Monica, they do their own report card. Oh, they probably get straight A's. No. This one, which just came out a year and a half ago, they got a C minus. They're almost failing. And one of the reasons was they weren't doing enough. This happens to be a parking structure in Santa Monica, and these panels on the top that you can see are solar panels. Again, part of the argument is this is space and area. The panels cover the cars to keep them cooler during the day, but they're also generating power. Why not? I mean, duh, I'd have to be a rocket scientist to figure that one out. Next slide. This also shows another area that we have to look at very closely, and that is our toilets, our water. We have to be mindful of the fact that you can actually save money, energy, and the environment by not using as much water. By, if you will, not necessarily flushing every time. By, you know, there is now things, there, they even have some urinals and all that are, you know, no flush at all. Waterless urinals. But the fact of the matter is, if we have plumbing systems that are much more aware of this and get those systems, you'll have much more of a water safety and less water usage. This actually is a slide that comes from a company called Toto. Anybody heard of that company, a Japanese company? Yeah, I own no shares in that company. I have no vested interest whatsoever. I'm just telling you, I've been working with them for 30 years almost. And they are way ahead in terms of being mindful about the environment, water, and waste use. Next slide. This is just to show the simple issue that I was talking about before. There's lots of other things, but this, in terms of design, how are you designing the communities? What are they going to look like in terms of architecture? Where are we going to put bike paths, walkways, as well as cars? Hopefully electric, or hopefully some that don't use any kind of fossil fuel. But the fact of the matter is, we've got to be thinking about these ideas and how all the pieces of it fit together. Next slide. This just shows some of the technology. Someone was asking me something a little bit about this morning. And the fact of the matter is, these things do exist, and any new idea, the best example is this. How many of you have one of these things? How many of you paid for it? No one paid for their phone? Good. Because if you did pay for it, talk to me. I'll get you one for free. You'll have to sign a 5-year contract and all the rest of it, and you'll get whatever. But the fact is, do you remember the days, and I apologize, I'm showing my age, when these things, by the way, I don't use an iPhone, and I apologize for all my friends who do, which is half the world. Their only reason is that it's not compatible with the stupid Verizon system I have. But anyway, how many remember the days when a cell phone, or whatever, was the size of a shoebox? Oh, yeah? Well, a few of you, right? Anybody remember what happened in San Francisco on the San Francisco Bay Bridge in 1987, a few years before Northridge? Earthquake! Collapse of the damn bridge. I was on it. And thank God I had a shoebox-sized stupidity thing I paid for at the time, because I was one of the few people on the dumb bridge that could communicate not only with my children at home, but also with other people. I was loaning my phone out probably to several dozens of people just so they can communicate to their loved ones. Cost of these things, folks, always goes down. That's why I'm showing you these slides. Because the fact of the matter is, a solar panel today, what they call geothermal, which is on the far left, and some of these other systems are a little bit more costly today, but they're coming down rapidly. I've even seen the cost of solar panels come down by probably more than a third over the last 2 or 3 years. And it's amazing how cheap they are these days. But I mention this to you because in part it's also showing you how wind can also be used. You see this wind turbine on top of a building? Because the flow of air comes to a building, comes up and over it, and you can capture that for power. I don't think it looks too bad myself, frankly. I mean, but the fact is, this is the kind of thing that we need to be looking at. And what we have to think about is where these technologies can be used and how costly they are. This system here is installed at Valley College, one of my former clients, for heating and cooling, a central plant system. We had the system put in 2 years ago, maybe a little over that. The expectation was a savings of maybe 10-15%. It actually saved almost 45% in power from these kinds of solar thermal systems. So what I'm getting at is we really can see the value in this, but you have to look at it not just as a cost benefit, but more of an externality longer, what we call life cycle analysis. Next one. Now I want to turn, how much time, who's keeping track of me? Doris, is someone?
Not dark yet.
Not dark yet? Yeah, you know me, right? I can go on. I, you know, give me the whatever, I want to take 12. Okay. But I do want to talk a little bit about China, all right? For a couple of reasons. Number one, I did that work and that study just to sort of illustrate where the Inner Mongolia area is. Here's Beijing. Inner Mongolia is right here. Here's Mongolia, but Inner Mongolia is part of People's Republic. What this chart shows is what the Chinese are really, really aware of. They are now the number one energy user in the world and now the number one polluter in the world. They took that distinction from us Americans last year. And I don't think they're proud of it. And I'm sort of as an American thing, I thank God it's not us anymore. But still, per capita, we're still the worst. But in general, in numbers, the Chinese have exceeded us. But what this shows, and again, I wish that the pointer was working, upper green area there at the top, that's natural gas coming from Russia. See, it's piped through the western part of China. And they're now talking about pipelines coming through here, northern China, through Mongolia, Inner Mongolia into China. You add that to, you can see, not too clearly here, but offshore, liquefied natural gas being shipped to China, offloaded, and then distributed throughout China. In addition to the coal, in addition to other things and demands of China, including nuclear power plants, the Chinese have a problem. They're aware of it. They said a 5-year plan, they're trying to do something about it by spending an enormous amount of money on renewable energy. But the reason they're aware of it is because what the Russians have done to Western Europe, same kind of system, they turn off the valve. Now remember what I said before about Enron company and other people in economics? When you turn off the valve, it's got nothing to do with market forces. It's got to do with being a crook. Sorry if you're Russian, I apologize. But the fact of the matter is, that's what's going on. Because people can manipulate those supplies in the market and demand a certain price and claim, oh, we have to have it repaired. I didn't know it would take 5 months. You know, I used to hear this, by the way, in the Davis administration from the Enron people. But the fact I'm trying to point out here is this is the problem that China's facing, and frankly, it's the problem we in America are facing. And we're facing the same problem together, and I think it behooves us and the Chinese to work collaboratively to solve it, because it's a major issue with all of us. Next slide. The Chinese, too, have wind resources. One of the things we recommended in this report to Inner Mongolia was shut down their coal production. It had to be done gradually for lots of reasons, but still shut it down. And if you look at this map through the upper part of you, you see the very good wind region they have there in Inner Mongolia for wind generation. Also very long areas for sun, a lot of solar possibilities. And they're now beginning to do that. Next slide. One of the other things I think is interesting, and I point this out to some of you who are in academics, is that some of the universities, this one is Tsinghua University, it's kind of the equivalent to MIT in the United States. Actually, a combination of MIT and Harvard together, to tell you the truth. But Tsinghua University in Beijing, all new buildings, a lot of them are energy efficient. When I first went there 20 years ago, it was like cobblestones. I mean, I don't mean nice cobble. I mean, these are just stones. I don't know if Tsinghua said it's cobble. But it was really a backward kind of place. And they brought it into, if you will, this third industrial revolution. Plus, they formed what they call also in Europe, and which I think we should do more in this country, science parks. Has anybody in the room ever heard of science parks before? What it basically is, it's not an incubator. It's a place where academics and their students and financial people work together, create a business, and then start it. And that business is financed and helped supported by not just local investors or venture capitalists, but also by people who are, you know, in government and or in other places like in banking in terms of debt and equity situations. So what you have is not just an incubator for starting a company, you actually have a place to create something and get it started into a viable business. Those incubators, those science parks are very, very, very prominent in Europe. I've written several papers about it, and they're now doing it at Tsinghua University in Beijing. Do we have science parks in the United States? Next, associated with UCLA? UC Riverside? Should I go on? Yes?
There's something up about Moffett Field in the San Jose area that's very similar.
Actually, I'm aware of that one. But that's the only one I know. And the question is, who are they associated with academically? Do you know?
Well, NASA's involved.
What academic university? I just a trick question, I know. No, they're close to Stanford, they're close to the University of Santa Clara, but the fact, and San Jose State University, the fact is it's trying to happen, but it's one of the few examples in the United States. You don't find them near Berkeley, you don't find them near Harvard, I mean, in a way, a little bit in Cambridge, but not too much. But what this does is allows a community to start building businesses using intellectual capital, if you will, of the academic institutions, along with the business community, and along with financial people. And that's the third industrial revolution again. Next one. So, here we have a new area outside of Shanghai called Dongtang. And this is an area, this is Shanghai, it's in the kind of the southern part of China in a way, not too far from Hong Kong. And what you have here is this island that's offshore, and they're turning the entire island into a sustainably developed community. No cars. You have wind turbines there, solar. The only way you get around, literally, is by having a light rail, a bicycle, and that's it. And if you need to go and commute to work, they have ferry boats to come from the shoreline to the Shanghai area for people to commute to work. We need to do more of that. This is happening already in other parts of the world. In the book on sustainable communities, I have examples in here from Denmark, from other parts of Europe, including Italy, other parts of the Asia, including Japan and other regions in China, which are really starting and doing these kinds of communities. I mention this to you because I have been told, I won't say where this happened, but a colleague of mine, a professor at another university, said I was going to give a talk on my book on sustainable communities, and he didn't know what I was there for. I mean, we're having lunch with about 10 people, and he said to me, "Well, you know, I'm glad you came here with Woody. I hadn't seen you in a few years. I just finished a book." I said, "Oh, what's the title of your book?" He said, "Oh, it's called Toward Sustainable Communities." And I said, "Oh, and when are they going to happen?" "Oh, it takes another 15, 20 years. He didn't come to my lecture, okay? Because I then said, "Well, see, my book is about the fact they already exist. They're all over the world, and there are only a few of them in this volume. But the fact is, ladies and gentlemen, they're there. We need to look at them, and we have to then look outside, down the street, how we got here today, and where we're going tomorrow. Next slide. Here's some of the technologies. This is a colleague of mine at the University of California, Davis. She's actually from Inner Mongolia. She's been teaching at Davis for about 25 years, and her whole family's here, and her children are here, and everyone else. And then she's developed a kind of a biodigester, anaerobic digester system that actually takes waste and turns it into energy and recycles all of it. Next slide. This is an example of where we could be going in the United States in terms of using ideas from other people in other parts of the world. But this is actually on the far upper left is a hydrogen refueling station that Honda has in Torrance, where its North American headquarters are. That's a hydrogen fuel cell car, which I'll get back to in a minute. But one of the reasons I wanted you to see this is the solar panels that are here. So what you're doing is actually getting electricity from the sun, electrolyzing that, and that turns into hydrogen that's then used for a hydrogen fuel cell car. Remember, hydrogen fuel cell car, which I'll mention in a little more detail, is no longer using a combustion engine. It's using a fuel cell. A very different kind of technology. Hydrogen can be gotten very easily from non-fossil fuels. Next one. On your bottom middle picture, that's me. Okay. I'm driving a demonstration of a GM hydrogen fuel cell car called the Equinox. I'll come back to that in a second. But under the hood, this is what the fuel cell looks like. You don't hear it like a combustion engine, and it actually just uses a fuel cell to provide electricity and the power for the car. Which, by the way, if anyone's driven an electric car, my God, the acceleration is unreal. Anyway, that's what that car is. Next one. This is what the new fueling station at Honda in Torrance is looking like with their new car that's on the market actually a couple years from now. And then there are also some of these systems being used, you can see, for refueling cars in your home. No longer driving into a Costco or getting in line at some gas station or something. The next slide. This is kind of complicated, but what it shows is, if you'll notice up there, kind of in the middle, 2015, 2016, every single car maker in the world is coming out with a hydrogen fuel cell car. Those cars will be on the road in 4 or 5 years. The car you saw me demonstrating driving is called the Equinox. GM is going to sell it at commercial rates, mass market rates. In other words, somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000. Think about all of this and what it could mean, because it really means getting us away from fossil fuels. Now, the commercialization of this hydrogen fuel cell car didn't come from GM initially, although they had the ability to do this years ago. It started with Honda, Toyota, Nissan, and also Daimler over in Germany. So they have been involved with it, and that's this chart shows when the release dates are coming from all these vehicles. Next one. So the third industrial revolution needs to come to America, and this is just one of those ways of trying to show it in terms of what people are referring to as high-speed rail. Have some of you heard about this in this region? And so one of the things I wanted to show was just how some of these areas are coming. What is going on? I don't think it's that well. That good. For some reason, I saw that I went through this. I don't think the focus is very good on it. I apologize. But you just have different parts of the United States, and the red lines are showing where some of the high-speed rail systems are going to be going. I apologize. It's not clear. But I do know that California has gotten in the middle of all of this by wanting to put a high-speed rail system going from north to south in California. I'm hoping, again, that using electricity, not using fossil fuels, or a series of other things that are issues that are still on the table. But it is being talked about, and there is some money that the voters have passed about it. Next slide. And this is an example of what the Japanese had in mind in terms of transportation and other systems. You'll notice on this chart, renewable energy coming from wind turbines, like on the shoreline there, and also I want to specifically be sure you notice they're coming from commercial areas, in this case near solar panels, but here as well, not just in the shoreline. There are solar panels all over. The system is using the vehicles to go back and forth. And what they're trying to do is really illustrate how we can have these kinds of systems if we're thinking ahead and be mindful of what the future is and what our needs are. Next one. And this is the conclusion. That's me with my 2.5-year-old son. Not grandson, son. So where did Dylan go? Is he still back there? Okay, I want you to meet this young man, okay? His name is Paxton. Pax for peace. Okay? You two have a lot in common. He's about 2.5 years old. His life is at stake. And that's why I'm here. Thank you.
Would you like to ask a few questions of Dr. Clark? I'll kind of work the room from one side to the other here.
I've been working in the hydrogen area for quite some time, and what we're, as you know, we can get hydrogen from water, we can get electricity from whatever source, like the sun or whatever, and then electrolyze that. What I come in constant conflict with is people who want to get hydrogen from natural gas or some other fossil fuel, and I totally disagree with that approach to it, but I do know there's a lot of pressure for people to do that. That's one reason I show slides about people generating electricity in their home, or using some other method to get the hydrogen for their car for themselves, not going through a station that's getting it from natural gas. But I do know that's where a lot of the pressure is coming from for that. Having worked a lot in politics on the state level and somewhat in Washington, I have my fingers crossed about the strength of the EPA, and there are other places in Washington too, including the Department of Energy. The issue it really is that leadership has to come in part from the president and then partly from the passing of some sort of a plan. And the reason I say that is because when I've been involved with political things, what happens is that if you don't have that support, people find all kinds of excuses not to do it. And I think that that's where the issues are. So it really means all of us in this room have got to speak up about these things and let the elected officials know, you know, they've got to do something about it. And then really it's important because this November there's going to be a major election in this country, and there could be a worse outcome than what some people are hoping we'll have, at least to stay even or, you know, steady as we go. So I think you have to do that. The other part of it is I know the EPA and other agencies are trying to work on this, but I think it's really very difficult. It's with their hands, one hand tied behind the back, frankly. The answer to that is really very complicated, because one of the problems here is you have what are called stranded costs. In other words, when you make these changes, then you're investing in areas, which means you're going to have to pay it back over a period of time. As an example, Mr. Obama had just announced the opening, I think, of 7 or 9, I can't remember what the number was, battery companies for batteries for electric vehicles. I think it's important to have electric vehicles. You've got to remember that they don't get as much miles or as many miles per charge or whatever, et cetera, et cetera. It takes longer. But I think that's important. The issue is not to put in billions of dollars that will need to be paid back over 15, 20, or 30 years, because I think we're moving beyond that. I'm not against electric vehicles at all. I'm very much in favor of them. But I do think it's a transitory thing. We have to be careful how much money we do. The biggest thing I have a problem with, and I said this earlier today in the sermon, is continuing to subsidize the fossil fuel industry by tax and other incentives, which have been going on literally for a century. It's ridiculous. If we all had to pay what the price is at the pump, we wouldn't be driving as much as we are, frankly. And I think we saw that happen. We had the glitch about a year or 2 years ago with the price of oil at the gas at the pump. And I think that's what we have to do, is get out of our stupid cars, to be honest about it. I wish there were more bike paths. Isn't it kind of flat here in Southern California? I don't understand that. Where are the bike paths? We had more bike paths in San Francisco than you have here. Anyway, sorry. I take that as a statement, not a question, but I agree. I agree. And I just want to warn everybody, too, that there are, I'm not going to talk specifically about what's coming up this fall, but there are people who've got a lot of money in the bank that they're throwing their, you know, to get elected. But which means we all have to go out and go to the polls, literally. I mean, without a question, bring our neighbors and friends and everyone else. But also the Supreme Court just made a ruling that sort of really allowed, if you will, a blank check to be signed by anybody, including those corporations. And I totally agree. That's really the basic problem here. Well, I've actually heard that before, because it was during the administration of someone who was running for governor again, you know, and those came out, those programs. It's kind of like this thing. In other words, the technology has improved so much that we don't see those kinds of issues today. And in fact, there's research going on in systems being installed on essentially nano solar technology, very small systems, I brought some things to show people that I'll get out before I leave. But the cost has come down dramatically, and I don't know how long your system lasted. Was it, what, 25, 30 years? A lot of those systems went for a long period, huh? Oh, you moved, okay. But I was going to mention something in my presentation which is related to that, and that is one of the things that's happening and what I'm trying to push, frankly, is that we need to look at solar for our homes in our office buildings the same way we look at plumbing, air conditioning, electrical systems. In other words, it's part of our infrastructure for our homes and our offices. Part of the mortgage that's being done in a slightly like that with a program that started in Berkeley. It's called the PACE program. And it was going to, I think, take off and do something like this, really. But the Fannie Mae people in Washington, D.C. put the kibosh on it, basically, and stopped it because they saw it as competition from what they were doing with their mortgage program. But that's what I think has to happen. When I was at Lawrence Livermore National Lab, a lot of people were working on fusion up there and still are. We had, I think the last count I remember is about, out of 8,300 people, employees, about 1,300 of them were physicists. Not all of them working in fusion, by the way, but a lot of them were in that area. And there's also I wouldn't call it a reactor, but a system up there that's in operation. The thing is that when I was in meetings about this about 10, 15 years ago, everybody in the room concluded that it's going to take 50 years or so before they're actually viable. So they're still working on it, but I do think it's the future. Then that gets to the question, should we keep putting billions of dollars into research and nuclear power or fusion or whatever? I do think we need to continue to do that work and start. The United States is drawn back from this, as you're probably aware, and we need to continue to be there. But I'm not sure we need nuclear power plants today because the fusion would be the what's going to happen in the future. That's a kind of a hard question to answer because, I mean, all of us, and including myself, I have to buy gas for my car, so where am I going to go? So I usually go into Costco or something like that to get it. It's usually cheaper there. And I don't know exactly where they get theirs from. I honestly can't say. I mean, for example, I know that Exxon, to me, is one of the most ridiculous companies in the world, I mean, in this area.
So,
Yeah. I would doubt. In fact, yeah, right. Only a C+. Because BP used to have a very good reputation in being very innovative and progressive. The answer to your question, I don't really know. I think the thing that we have to be careful about is not necessarily the fuel source itself, but what we're driving. So what we need to do is be sure we're driving something that doesn't demand a lot of it, and then look for places where there's going to be, you know, reasonable things, or, you know, to have a hybrid car or all electric car where we can get the charge. By the way, on electric cars, one of the issues is where is that electricity coming from? You know, is it coming from a coal fire plant that's out in the Four Corners or something like that? And what I've been urging people to do is that's why they should have solar panels in their homes or their businesses where they can recharge the car. So I don't have a real answer for that, and I certainly wouldn't go on record to say that, you know, go buy Chevron versus Exxon. But I think it's a problem, and I'm not sure exactly how to solve it. I don't know.
Being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize is very affirming of your work. Can you reflect at all on the significance of that? Why now, and how they came to that decision?
Let's see. When am I coming back again? That's a long story. I've actually given talks just on that topic, but I'll try to make this very short and to the point. Most of us, when we work on these things, had no idea that was going to happen, okay? And actually, in other fields, in chemistry and physics and other, that's common. People just don't know that's what's going to happen. I got involved with the climate issues back in the early 1990s, in part because I saw this as a problem. It was also something identified in the Rio summit that happened in the early 1990s. And then myself and some others, you know, we started to become very interested in it. Then when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, was formed, and having these meetings that they had in the mid-1990s, I was only one of two people at Lawrence Livermore Lab participating. Remember I said 8,300 people. There were only two of us. And we would go, in my case, on my own time. I had to get expense money covered by the UN, and I had to take off time from work to go do this. which was a really bad thing to do if you think about my own retirement and other things, you know. But I did it because I was passionate about it. I realized there's something going on here. Now, there are a lot of stories, and I'll just tell you one, just so that all you can, the reason why I still stay involved and get involved with it. We had a final report writing, 129 nations. We met in Nepal. It was in 1998. I'll never forget it. There were hundreds of people. I mean, I think the U.S. had six representatives. China had five or six, and U.K. had five. And other countries tend to have less. I think Germany maybe four. But we had all these people. Then you had the two chairs, one of whom was on the... actually, both of these guys have been involved, and you see them on TV with the Nobel Prize winning. Then they had the group of us experts over here, and they chose of all the experts, like I think we had about 140 people working on this report. They only chose 13. By the way, 13 is my lucky number. So they had us sitting over here on the side, had all these people from different countries in back of us on this kind of really huge auditorium. And then what happened was unbelievable after that. We sat at our first meeting. We were supposed to be there for 2.5 days and then come up with a report, a summary report of this third report of the IPCC. The guy who was in charge of the experts is a law professor from Stanford. I knew him, worked with him before. We got involved in this thing together, whatever. So he's there. We start off the meeting. He goes back to his room, and that night his back went out on him. He couldn't move, literally. He was, I mean, the travel, the stress, unbelievable. So the next person in line was a fellow from India. He is also a lawyer teaching at MIT, okay? Knew him as well. Well, I go to his room the next morning, and after we found out this other fellow, Tom, was ill, I go to the fellow's room, the other guy, and he got a bite on his leg. It swelled up. Remember I told you about the shoebox size cell phone? His leg was swollen three times as much. I never saw anything like it. So I took him to the emergency room in the hospital, and he says, "Woody, will you take over being in charge of the experts?" I said, "What?" He said, "Well, Tom is out. I'm next, and then we want you to be the third." I already checked with Tom and some other people. I said, "You've got to be kidding." Because what we had to do as the experts, and then I did it for like 2 days straight, almost 24/7, is keep order among all these people in 129 nations. So this is going to be online, right? So publicly, I want to make this announcement. Don't deal with people from the United States and trying to get a consensus. The delegates from the U.S. were idiots. I couldn't believe it. And the second group of people from the U.K. That was unbelievable. I had never had to sit there trying to keep order with someone from the U.K. who would say, "Well, it should be could." His colleague, "No, it's would." I go, "What the hell are you talking about? You know, let's get down to something." We went, I mean, it was, I finally had to take charge and say, "Look, by the way, I'm kind of a legal parliamentarian type anyway. I go, wait a second here." So, I mean, I had to kind of keep order of these guys just to get them to move forward and go through all these words and sentences. But the bottom line is the experience was great. When I got in state government, I couldn't continue participating because we weren't allowed to travel outside the United States or even California, like in Governor Davis's office. And so I got a little bit disconnected from the whole thing until the Nobel came. And then some of my friends who were continuing to work with them got hold of me and said, "Woody, did you realize that you're aware of it?" And I said, "Really?" I said, "You're kidding, you know." And the first people I told were my two younger brothers and my wife. And they said, "Get out of here." Everybody, I had to prove to my two younger brothers. I got a certificate from winning it with my name on it. And I actually had to send my two younger brothers a certificate and say, "You see, I won the stupid thing," you know? And it was really funny because it's so shocking and so surprising. But the bottom line is, what's important about it is that I've been in this field for a long time, and there are a lot of people who are all of a sudden sustainable and green yesterday, and it helps in doing what I call the due diligence in this field. Because you have no idea how many people just come through the door and say, "Oh, I'm green this, I'm green that," and they want to get paid, you know, enormous amounts of money. And they, you know, say the right things, but they don't know what they're talking about. I had an instance, and I mentioned this on purpose, because there was a person from, I was consulting for the LA Community College District, 9 college campuses, getting them all energy independent, carbon neutral. And we had a person come to us who claimed to be a wind expert, having worked on the wind turbine that I mentioned in Ontario, Canada. Turns out, I know the guy who was in charge of that program, a very close friend of mine, known him for a decade or more. And I asked him, he said, well, so-and-so is a crook. I said, what do you mean? This person never worked on this project, was fired, and, you know, I can't tell you much more because of legal things. But check with ABC College and ABC HR group. I checked with a college, and lo and behold, this person did not even graduate from the college, having claimed having an engineering degree. So I took some action, and we had this person removed, basically, or actually, it took almost 8 months. But what I'm saying is that that's not the only case of that. There's a lot of cases, situations where someone says, "Oh, I'm agreeing this, and I'm agreeing that," and I'm, you know, and they're not. So having been involved in this field for quite some time, I really, really pay attention to the due diligence aspect of it. I urge all of you to do that as well, by the way. Yes.
My name is Steve Wallace. I'm from the Unitarian Church up in Riverside. Some years ago, I used to live in the Westwood Village area around UCLA, and even then, the traffic was horrendous there, and that I became aware sometime after that of a company that had built something in Germany called Cabin Taxi, and they it was a form of what they call personal rapid transit, pop cars is another name for it. And I've always been fascinated with that mode of transportation. I'm wondering if you're familiar with it and if you have any thoughts about it.
I'm not, but I just to pick up on that a little bit, I mean, some of you are aware of the fact that I was kidding in a way about bicycles. We don't have them, you know, and one of the things that they should have at UCLA or UC Riverside even is, you know, areas for people to ride their bikes. Again, if you go to Europe, you can actually get a bike, put a, you know, euro in the slot, you know, go ride the thing out and put it back, get your euro back at the end of the day. Duh, what happened in our country? Why don't we do these simple things? But I haven't heard of that, so it's interesting. Yeah, the tragedy is we don't, not only do we not do anything about it, but it's probably getting bigger and bigger and bigger as we speak, and there's probably more than just one area that we don't know about. This is one reason why I talked earlier about a 5-year plan, and also why we have to do something that's kind of watching these things. I'm glad now that we have some federal regulations on money, all the stimulus money and what's happened, and reading about a couple of executives getting in the billions of dollars of, you know, with our taxpayer money is upsetting. But I don't know of an answer to that still. In terms of hydroelectric power, I normally don't mention it because a lot of us in renewable energy usually don't associate hydroelectric power with renewable energy, partly because of the environmental impact of hydroelectric in terms of dams and other things. Instead, what we talk about are run of the river, meaning that when rivers are flowing, you can have these small turbines that actually can generate power from the flow of the river. So that's, in general, people in the renewable energy sector don't talk about hydroelectric power as renewable. I've worked a lot with BC folks up in Northern California, Silicon Valley in particular, not too much down here in Southern California, but a little bit. And what I've done, and I co-chaired a program at UC Berkeley last fall on, it was called the Green Tech Institute. It was part of the Haas School Executive Degree Program. So I've interacted a lot with VCs in there, plus some in China and also in Europe. There is, though, a very important distinction between, I wasn't the one that created the name green clean tech, but there's a very big distinction between clean technology and what I call green technology. And so a lot of the venture capital firms I know of or heard about are talking about clean tech this and clean tech that. When you get into a qualitative economist that I am, when you ask what they mean by that, they mean things that are, you know, almost to the point, and I'm not being funny, clean coal technology. I mean, it's not an oxymoron to some of them, but I think it is. That was a joke. I'm going to get that. All right. Or things like natural gas, you know, which is cleaner, if you will, but still a fossil fuel. So I'm much more interested in working in, if you will, green tech areas, and I am very conscious and aware of the cost of making these products and things and where that's coming from. Now, I might say that I'm not involved working with anybody in that area right now. I'm I've been exploring and looking into it a little bit. My first priority was some consulting that I was doing for the community colleges that ended in these two books that just came out, so I'm sort of keeping the door open for different opportunities. But the other side of it is, I may sound like I'm being a little dogmatic, if you will, but I just don't want to go work or associate with someone or some group that's not, from what my point of view, very strongly directed in this area and committed to the green tech approach. That also gets into the issues of the installation and systems and other things. Now, what I have noticed is that there are some companies in China that, and then they have to go through all kinds of standards and stuff in their products. But it's interesting, I was telling someone earlier before the session started, that the Chinese now have come up with a very interesting model. Whereas in the venture capital community and finance community, if you have a solar program and you want to have solar panels on top of a building or a shopping mall or whatever, you buy the panels, you go maybe to a VC person and or a bank and get your debt equity set up, or now something I didn't mention in detail earlier is they have what they call power purchase agreements. You put that in place, pay for the system over 20 years, et cetera, but every year you make, or every month you make a payment for your solar program. The Chinese have a program where they're actually now, if you want to buy a system, you can go to a bank and or a finance group. The only caveat to it is you have to buy a Chinese solar system or a wind system, whatever. Now, I have problems with that on one level, but on the other part of it, I think it's a form of genius. Why don't we do that? Why don't the Germans do it? Why don't other people combine, in other words, the financing with the product? And I haven't seen that done in outside of China. But I do think it's important for the venture capital community to get in this area, and sooner than later, they certainly were successful when they did it in life sciences and biotech, and I know a lot of those people over the years. But I just see it, and I can name names, I can just kind of see it kind of starting, you know, and moving there, but not as much as they should be. Does that answer your question? Somewhat? Yeah, well, you can contact me with my email or whatever you want more. Well, I think the way to respond to that is that the reason I'm here is because of that. It's because you and I and others are aware, and we need to know what and how to do something about it and share information. And I think, as you and some other people have indicated, also take some action politically, including watching who gets the money and where it's spent. But all I can say is this, that as I am part of the baby boomer generation, I may not live long enough to see this stopped and totally reversed. I hope I do, which means, you know, it may take a few years. But I'm going to do it till the day I die. A colleague of mine, you may have read, just passed away. He was a member of the IPCC, and he just died at the age of 65. And he was coming back from Europe, where he was working with people on these issues, and very active in the IPCC, and he gave his life. What can I say?
So, hold on.
So we have a challenge, and the challenge is for the young people, the Dillons, and my son, and your grandsons, and your grandchildren, and granddaughters. We have a big challenge. And it's not going to stop immediately. We have to take the little steps, but we also have to take the big steps. Part of the big steps, I think, are going to come from our colleague here who said something about where the money is coming from, or from the investment community, because that's really part of the leadership in it. But it's also going to come from all of us and what we do in our daily lives. Plus, we have to speak out about it. I've been asked by the U.S. State Department to go to China in early October and spend almost 2 weeks there talking to the Chinese about this issue, because you may know that in Copenhagen, the Americans and the Chinese just locked horns. It was, and I've been asked by you know, Hillary Clinton and the State Department to go and start talking about this, and it's going to be stressful. Then last week, a week ago tomorrow, I was called by another group in the State Department and asked to go to East Africa in like 2 weeks to go and talk. Spend 2 weeks in Africa talking to governments and people there. I've never been to Africa in my life. Would I go? I'm only going because it's important. that's again one of the issues, is that I'm not sure how many people in Washington realize how important this is to our national security. That's one reason I was showing the chart about China. We need to look at our world and look at ourselves and just stop all this folly. I mean, one thing I want to be clear about, though, is most of our oil is actually gotten from Mexico and Canada, plus a smaller percent, which is here in the United States. So we don't get all that much oil from the Middle East, but it is considerable. But the fact of the matter is that we do have a responsibility. It gets to what the lady was just talking about, because when we buy gasoline here, it finds its way over to the Middle East in one way or the other. And so, again, the future generations are going to, you know, feel that impact, frankly, financially and otherwise. So the point is, we've got to stop being dependent on others. That's really where it comes down to. And the way to do that is by using these renewable sources where we do have access to the sun. It doesn't mean being totally, in other words, you've got to be sure, that's why I said about integrated systems and using various areas. But I don't think the politicians totally understand this, is what it comes down to. And, you know, I can give you excuses and tell you what they tell me or whatever, but the bottom line is there are other people with deep pockets who are influencing a lot of the politicians, and that's really what it is. And it's similar to what I was saying before about the need for bicycles and the need for us to do things that are different. I mean, here in the community, I'm sure in your community as well, we need to push for bicycle paths, dedicated places, and the ability to get them and have access to be sure we and our children and our children's children are riding them and using them. But we don't have that right now, and that's a local kind of thing that all of us can do.
It's Dr. Clark.